ease my pain, seeing them on the dusty hallway floor, backs against the wall, caressing those glossy Cadillacs. The notion that we could have Neil to stay for a weekend. I certainly did not rush into it, as Titch later said. I certainly did not ask the Bolts' opinion, but anyone could see those boys were born to be each other's friend. I was not conniving or meddlesome, the opposite. I tested Ronnie's feelings first, then Edith's. At that stage, she was perfectly amenable. The complaints began after the first weekend. She then said I was embarrassing.
The way you grin and fawn on him. Can you quit it, Mum?
Who had heard of such a thing? A girl being jealous of a boy. But she resented any kindness I showed, big or small. She was outraged that I dared pat his little head, and that I drove all the way to Melbourne to pick him up and then drove him home afterwards.
"Your pet monkey,"
she said, and I slapped her, and she would not talk to me for days. And it was not until her father came home that she rejoined the human race, sitting in his lap and tickling him. She was lucky to have a father at all, I told her. This also was a cause of great offence, but I must say I did look forward to those weekends when Adelina sent us Neil Barkhuber, as I thought of him. It was a relief for her, of course, with her husband not really being her husband, and she working 6 days a week and selling bric-a-brac on Sundays. I never honestly thought about the boy's skin colour. Of course it was a shock the first time I met him, but I was more disturbed by his stand-in father, who was black and sissy and smelling pretty, with hands so very soft and dry. In the autumn I was quite often in Melbourne with the two boys, and then I could not help but feel the world's opinion, in the back of a taxi, say, with the driver's eyes on me, thinking his dirty thoughts, imagining what I'd been up to. How many times was I asked where I came from, what age the boys were, and where they went to school? Ronnie was boisterous and bouncy, and Neil was careful and exact, but they were continually amused by each other. What a shame it was that Willie never had a chance to see them looking through his gold-stamped foreign language books. None of this was in my mind when I took that photograph. It was not a very good one anyway, like a million photographs taken with box brownies. Two boys in swimming togs, a grey, paling fence behind them. Their arms around each other's shoulders, squinting in the sun. Yes, one was black and one was white, but no one remarked on it when I picked up the Kodak envelope from the chemist shop. Of course it is well known they look through everything when the pictures are delivered. In any case, what bad thing could they possibly think? I had been up to something, but what? What possibly? I placed the photograph in an envelope and addressed it to Neil's father. He had a right. I was claiming nothing from him. I was not related to the son. Please tell me what is so strange about offering solace to a lonely man.
Chapter 18. I had waited for it, the wet season, through every blistering morning and the heated rocks of afternoon, and still I was not prepared. Not for its density, immensity, the roar upon the roof, the obliteration of all distance, the air sucked from my lungs as if it meant to kill me. This rain was the temperature of blood. It polished the tree trunks until they shone. A billabong appeared from nowhere, right by the camp. It brought the trombone cries of frogs, splashing, laughter. My cross-cultural scholars ducked and dived and brushed their teeth with broken twigs and arrived clean and shining at their desks. The crossing bridge was said to be in danger. The landscape out my bedroom window was a necklace of islands in swirling, cack-coloured water. I thought of Tom Taylor and his ark. It was at this unlikely time that families began to leave the camp to go about their ceremonies and other law business in their countries. Oliver Emu did not have to go anywhere. This was his country, and he would soon face his initiation. and I saw his silent apprehension and excitement as the days passed. Then, suddenly, his desk was empty, and I heard he had run away to the missionaries who took him in to protect him from these barbaric practices. "Just like one of those girls," said his grandfather. "They did the same to escape their old man husbands." "All bugger up," Dr. Battery said mournfully. "The boy would get a hiding when he found him." It was dry in the classroom, but sometimes in my dreams I heard the water working inside the limestone walls. It had been water, of course, that made my schoolroom cave. Not by erosion, but the action of carbonic acid. Water combining with carbon dioxide. Off he goes. I thought all this slow evacuating was not simply finished because Captain Cook had come. Caves were being created still. The Kimberley was riddled with them. In one of these, I thought, the Punkawalla had his secret ark and all its treasure. It was from caves like mine that the great clever man, a.k.a. Pigeon or Jandamara or the Black Ned Kelly, had conducted his lethal raids upon the Kimberley police. Jandamara had known finger talk, by which language he spoke silently to his followers while they stalked the white police. I also had learned finger talk and stick talk, and I encouraged my kids to make stick talk paintings while water rose in the billabong and creeks rushed down what had once been dry and rocky gullies. The pupils, boys and girls, could all imitate the tracks of animals and reptiles, and I had them dip their fingertips in ink and print with them, always removing the paper before they mucked it up. When each child had a best painting, I transferred it to the limestone personally. "Like a public toilet," said Carter, when he saw these paintings on the classroom walls, the gorgeous blue and white like a willow pattern. The saga of Captain Cook, which I had transcribed line by line, a pillar from the earth to heaven, also the maps of ancestral chases stretching horizontal across the clean white space that had once shown the bulldozed lines of the Whitefella Highway. "I can't wait to see old Garrett's face," said the manager. "He'll shit his pants." He was as vile as usual, but there was something else illuminating the golden beaky countenance, a naughty boy's delight in mischief. He still judged me weak as water, a bung lover, a half-caste, if not quite a poofter, but he was impressed that I had not yet gone mad or spat the dummy, so he watched me, waiting, like I was a good story that had not reached its climax. He could not believe I had held his interest for so long. Of course, I would be gone by the time Garrett finally returned, but I too would have liked to see the inspector's compromised and weather-worn expression when he finally understood that a human place of education might be sweeter than a church. The dusty cave school had disappeared, and in its place was... what? Like what? An ancient chapel made by Bosnian Christians hiding from the Turks? As the rain continued, Dr. Battery remained my instructor. It was, as he never ceased to tell me, not too late for me to be a proper blackfella. I was his son, and he would take me to see secret boards. When our mob had granted their approval, and in the meantime we squatted amongst the empty bottles in his humpy, and he taught me, for instance, that the flying foxes are the dreaming companions of the rainbow snakes. When the snake spill that flying fox, he know time. He's a young fella, that old snake. He frisky, Billy. He plenty busy now, sticking his head up out of the water. Inside the humpy, there was no escaping the stink of autumn brown sherry and musky flying fox, and I could see the rainbow serpent in my mind's eye, his mouth sprung open, shooting out lightning and saliva. "Tadpoles swimming in his spit," said Dr. Battery, communicating ancient lore, or teasing me, or both at once. The spit was rain, he said. Now the lightning people will wake up proper. See, Uncle Red X, the lightning women flash their lightning more and more. Look 'em now, steam up into clouds, grubs and frogs, them bosses of the rain. They sing to the rainbow, more, more. Down it comes, the rain. The water's dark and muddy, he said. And I was a silly bugger, he added, and I'd better keep away from those whirlpools in case I got dragged in and drowned. It was mournful down in the camp with so many gone. Carter came to my residence to stack the fridge with his extra beer. I asked him, very casually, as this was the best style with him, why the people had holidays at this time of year when it was hard for them to travel around the floods to their distant countries. Surely the wet season was a better time for the kids to be inside at school. Dry season would be a better holiday. Don't be a nong, he said. We don't run this business for their convenience. I was a nong, I thought. This was all for the bloody pastoral companies. Now there was so little station work, they could have their precious holidays. This must have been a small saving for the station, who had suffered the expense of feeding the people tea, sugar, beef, and weevil flour. But when the wet arrived, my blood relations returned their station clothes to Annie in the store. She wrote each man and woman a chit and saved it in a Brockhoff biscuit tin so they could claim them on return. If the eagle had not taken me, this might have been my life, I thought, frightened of the naked truth of their revealed anatomies, tall, thin and fat, young fruit, male and female, wrinkled with shocking, unarguable facts and characters as distinct as the human face. As the majority of camp residents departed, the stockman returned. Tackman, as they say. The last to arrive had been 300 miles from camp when the deluge began, and they had a slow, wet ride back through rain, their shirts and pants soaked, the horses floundering in the bogs. Days were added to their journey by their diversions around the heads of newly flooded creeks. Their salt beef went sour. At day's end, they squatted round their hissing campfire, holding their hats over the frying pan to keep their damper dry. Mrs. Carter and the kids were far away down south on the dry, hot plains of Corangamite, where they would not see a black face from one year to the next. So when Carter invited the white stockman for a Christmas booze-up, my fridge would soon be emptied, and there would be no moderating influence from the missus. I had no choice but to attend, knowing pretty much how things would go. I would arrive early when everyone was sober. At this stage I would be thought acceptable, sometimes interesting, even admirable. But my job was regarded as a waste of time, and it wouldn't take long before someone felt compelled to tell me no offence. It would be noted that I didn't drink. It would be necessary for me to point out that I was not a temperance wowser. Did you never even taste it? They would want to know. It would be unfair for me to generalise about the races on Quamby Downs, but there would always be, in any gathering of white men at this station, a certain number with pathological or psychotic tendencies, and it was these, it seemed, who set the tone. Perhaps this would have been different had I the spine to oppose them openly. It is perhaps a weak excuse to say that I could always rely on Carter to expose my secret thoughts, which he did most effectively at the Christmas booze-up, by taking an inspection party out to the caves. Thus, I suppose, he forced me to speak up. I should have been pleased by the shock caused by the writing on the wall, but I was unprepared for their crude hostilities to the saga of Captain Cook. My exit was accompanied by a silence so threatening that when I returned to the residence, I locked the door. Soon there would be a call for the beer in my fridge, and I would have no choice but to unlock. Therefore, I remained at the kitchen table and tried to read the silly opera book. When there was gunfire from the big house veranda, I didn't take it personally, but when a rock landed on my parked car, I jumped. Then there came a mighty bang above my head. A brick, I thought, but it could have been anything. Then came a knocking on my door, so faint and scratchy that all the hair stood on my arms. I extinguished my bright kerosene lamp and picked up my torch. The bolt would not come quickly, so I slammed it open and flung wide the door, which banged against the wall. It was Susie Shuttle in my torch beam, in her clean school clothes, in the middle of the night. I thought, she has been into the school. She's dressed in her best clothes. How hooded was her brow? "They need a doctor," she said. My torch found a young couple with a baby, whose left eye was closed and oozing pus. One side of its face was hot and swollen with infection. Susie didn't know that I had already used my stash of petrol taking her family hunting. She had no idea I was scared to venture out in this weather, and I feared being washed away and drowned. "This baby is going to die," she announced. I introduced my silent visitors to my table, where I had to order them to sit. Having directed Susie to make them tea, I carried an empty petrol flagon through the puddles, knowing, of course, that a flagon of petrol would get us nowhere, but hoping that in the midst of all the happy celebration, it would make the purpose of my mission clear. Things were said about me. No need to repeat what they were. I waited while Carter defeated a young jackaroo in a knuckles contest, which had already made the young fellow's hand a bruised and nasty blue. "You're an idiot," he told me when he had his victory, but he gave me the key to the padlock that secured the petrol pump. I then acted as if I would really drive to the distant hospital. I bundled the parents and their baby in the back and Susie in the front, and I removed the sheet of corrugated iron which had substituted for the missing windscreen. As the water poured onto my knees, as the engine fired, the rain began again, and I didn't think of anything but navigating to the station workshop. I had spent many hours there with old Battery, and of course he had found it very useful for me to learn the ways of the workshop generator. So now I brought the monster into roaring life, providing power for lights, and then the petrol pump. I thought Mrs. Bobsey would be amazed by my competence. I applied the key to the lock. It didn't fit. I thought, I am saved. I don't have to drown myself. But then I heard the baby's broken breath and became the servant of a different fear, that I would kill it with ineptitude. Susie Shuttle was right beside me as we entered the big house, and it was she who led the charge to Carter, who paused with his beer bottle still inches from his pouting lips. "What are you doing here?" he asked, and I was surprised that it was Susie he addressed. "You gave us the wrong key, boss." "Maybe the problem is the hole," said Carter, speaking in a manner that I attributed to drink. "We need the correct key," I said. Carter rubbed himself obscenely. "My point of view exactly." There had been a great deal of hooting and barracking until then, but now there was a silence. I expected to get beaten, and was, in the midst of everything, surprised I didn't care. "Quit it," Susie said. "We need the bloody key. The baby is going to die." Carter made a grab for her knee, but she stepped back. "Barry," she said. "What? Where's your missus, Barry?" It was impossible she would speak to him like this, not just raise her voice, but use this familiar first name which I had never heard before. She was my sturdy, clever pupil, just 16 years old, but her eyes were on fire, and she was not afraid, and I understood that Carter, somehow, was going to listen to her. "You're a little bit pissed," she said gently, "but you can save a baby. Barry, please."
"Suit yourself," he said.
What an odd choice of words, I thought. From a station boss to a camp girl. He dug into his pocket and then stumbled across the room to that mess he called his office. Here he fiddled with the filing cabinet, from which he finally extracted a single key ring which he dangled before my surprising pupil. "But don't you make assumptions, girlie." "Thank you," she said. "You understand what I'm saying?" "Yes." "You've got a real future, Susie," he said, and flung the key out into the night. Chapter 19. In the moonless dark, between the sick baby and the tiny hospital, lay the engorged Mardawarra River, with its brown skirts frothing against the upstream edge of the old 2-mile bridge. Of course, the baby's parents must risk this crossing. So must I. But there was no reason for a schoolgirl to venture out onto a structure that might be swept away at any moment. I told her to get out. I would pick her up on my return. The Peugeot smelled of damp and mould and rotting rags. I took a breath and engaged low gear. If my headlights and my eyes were full of rain, I could still make out the luminous figure of that wilful girl walking backwards on the bridge, gesturing that she would guide me. The bridge, being always temporary, had no parapet, but of course my sturdy student had lived through many wet seasons and must be familiar with situations just like this. I told myself, "Willie, there's only an inch or two of water. Do not be a southern wonder." Of the baby whose life we were intent on saving, I honestly have no memory, only of the ghost girl in my headlights and my fear she would be swept away. The current was strong. The water surged upwards on her shins. A floating log slammed against the rear and the back wheel shifted. The mother was behind me, speaking rapidly in her tongue. I clamped myself around the steering wheel and dared not shift my eyes until at last the front tires were churning and the object of my attention was scrambling up the track ahead. I have only the vaguest recollection of the dark hospital and then the ferocious camp dogs who attacked me as I tried to find a nurse. I suppose I was drunk on adrenaline. I remember no particular satisfaction when the child was in safe hands. As far as I knew, we didn't have to risk the bridge again. I could have stayed there for a week, more likely two, until the flood subsided. And when I was back, looking out across the flooded bridge again, this really seemed the wisest thing to do, but my passenger had her own private motivations. "Hang on, boss," said the sneaky, clever child as she got out of the car and shut the door behind her. I was the teacher, she the pupil, but it was her country. I mean, it was not insane to trust her judgment that she might lead the way across. To me, the river seemed a different beast since last we crossed. Not only had the water risen, but there was more debris which now jacked the tires just a little, an inch or less, but sufficient to lose a percentage of traction and permit the water to get a better hold of me. In midstream, the edge of the bridge was not even visible, and I was steering against the current, feeling how the Peugeot wished to float. The girl took two careless, stumbling steps, and I thought she was gone, but she recovered, and from that point there was no option for either of us but to inch towards the shore. She tripped a second time, and I thought her lost, but then she grabbed the bumper bar and, as I watched, climbed like a river creature onto the steaming hood. Then my tires were spinning in the welcome mud, and I saw her marvellous white teeth laughing, and she crawled across directly through the absent windscreen, and her clothes were drenched and pasted to her like clay slip in a sculptor's studio. She rolled forward into the passenger seat and poured water from her sand shoes out her window, and I thought, "One day, Susie Shuttle, you will be an important woman." But then I was back at Quamby Downs and what had become my normal life. My first business was with the punker waller, who I found sitting on a kerosene drum on the wrong side of my gate. At this early hour he should have been at work in the laundry, but Carter was away dealing with a broken windmill, and my visitor had planted himself fearlessly at my gate. He faced my front door, knees close to the offensively named boy wire. Why he was waiting for me he wouldn't say, and, being the punkah-waller, he was bad-tempered because I couldn't read his mind. Would he like a cuppa? No, he wouldn't. He rested a poor, fragile leg across a knee, and I saw his starving childhood and was now alert to the scars across those barky shins. When it was time for class, I bade him farewell. He was still at his post at lunchtime, joined by curly-headed Crowbar, who was a distinct contrast to his wound-up friend. Yes, Bill, certainly he would like a cuppa. I returned with the tea things and saw the kerosene drum had been placed in such a way that it became a table, and I was provided with delicate shade from a half-dead poinciana sapling. My visitors each took a staggering amount of sugar, which I was no longer shocked by, and there then followed one of those companionable silences I had come to know at Quamby Downs. "Good car, eh?" Crowbar grinned at last, and I thought, of course, he knows we drove across the flooded bridge last night. Nearby, the Peugeot steamed like a bucket of old rags. "Good car," I said. He arranged his hat. "Electric's okay, no worries." "Thank you." Crowbar pushed his brim back and explained what he had done to waterproof the electrics. This technical chatter was very welcome to me, but not tolerable to the punkah-waller, who spiked it with sarcastic-sounding commentary until, suddenly, he threw his unfinished tea onto the dirt. He stared fixedly away from me. He spat. He began a long, belligerent complaint, and stopped abruptly. Crowbar sipped his tea with his habitual equanimity. The punkah-waller's voice now entered a new high register, and when he had reached the true climax of his indignation, he spat a second time. "Okay." The quiet returned. I asked Crowbar what I had done to offend his mate. He drew something in the dirt and flicked it away with his long fingers. He explained that Tommy had given me a gift of petrol. The punkah-waller nodded and curled his long black hair around his fingers and knotted it, and I looked into his yellow whites. Crowbar translated. "It was a present," he said. "Now I had used it up. If I was a true blackfella, I would know what was expected of me." I explained we had to save the baby's life. The punkah-waller understood me perfectly. "Bullshit," he said. "I give you, you give me." After some consideration, he added, "Baby bullshit." I placed my hand on my heart and said I would repay the gift. He said he was giving me a chance no one else would. Not Lockie, no one. He could make me a proper blackfella. He would teach me how. Without this, I would be alone. No one would want to marry me. No one would like my kids. On the Ark, I could have many wives. It would be difficult to exaggerate how fiercely this pressed hard on the raw nerve of my life. The midnight fear I would always be from nowhere. How lonely and exhausting it was to live inside my skin, to spend my nights gluing the pressed plants into a big notebook, transcribing the names my class had taught me, to wake each morning frayed, disconnected, and know I did not belong. I said I understood the value of what he was offering. He leapt to his feet. He spat. He walked away. Then, as I had seen a man in the camp return to the source of his offence, declaring outrage, shaking a stick or an axe, appealing to the witnesses to judge his case, he came running back to me and stopped a foot away. Then all the hard features softened and the eyes were wet. He would siphon more juice and bring it to me. He would save a place for me on his secret ark. He spoke in English very clearly. I could bring plenty books too. Too much paper from Sydney, big London, what I wished. Plenty jewels and crystals on that ark already. I could bring more stuff from inside my house here. There was room for a wireless, Kero fridge. If I did not bring these things, they would all be washed away. My whole residence, Carter's big house, too. I thanked him. But did I understand what he was giving me? I thought so. Then he would tell me once again. Carter, Carter's kids, jackaroos, policemen, welfare, all the Cartier would drown. Christmas trees would catch on fire. Any time now, he said, and I imagined blazing Christmas trees ascending, swallowed by the clouds. It was important that I listen to him, but it was essential I be in class. In making my excuses, I was clumsy. I pointed to the sky. No rain, I said. All gone. I smiled, meaning we could discuss the apocalypse on another day. No rain bullshit, Tom the tailor cried in perfect convent English. Gone. Ha! He shouted. Ha! Ha! He turned towards the camp and then came back. He ripped a branch from the poinciana and looked like he would whip me with it. Instead, he stamped on it and trampled it down into the mud. You wait. You see. Big rain. That girl, she be washed away. What girl? That wife you got. She been finished now. Old Cricket got her in the house. They drown inside his bloody bed. To pay him back, I asked him what about the bloody car. Would that be washed away as well? You cunt, he said to me, and I saw his coated tongue like a cockatoo's in his dark mouth. Poor stupid fellow you. Better lock that door tonight. Tom Taylor had always walked faster than was quite normal, and now he scurried along the side wall of my residence and disappeared from view. I asked Crowbar, was it possible that the Punkawalla had just threatened to sing me to death? Crowbar produced a roll of chewed-up, stinky tobacco. He said a black man could only sing a black man. He selected a choice piece of baccy and placed it delicately inside his cheek. He said that if a white man could be sung, they could be killed. So many Cartier been killed long time ago. Carter, for instance. Big Kev Little would have his kidney fat all stolen, his insides filled with snakes and crystals. But had he forgotten I was a blackfella? Ah, yes, he said. He looked away from me out to the eastern horizon where soft cumulus clouds were massing once again. Maybe you go with him, he said. He teach you law a little bit. Gammon law, I said. This was to claim more knowledge than I had. Safer you be mates with him, Bill. Of course, I did not wish to face whatever dangers would be involved in becoming the pariah's follower. But nor did I wish such a fierce fellow to become my enemy. For this reason I soon paid the Punkawalla a visit, crawling on my hands and knees through the tiny door, bringing a tribute of tea and sugar. I expected to be offered tea. None came. Then, what choice did I have? I said I would drive him to his ark. He accepted, but I saw no cuppa was forthcoming. I returned to the teacher's residence and wondered when that petrol might arrive and who would bring it and who I might offend, but all of these complicated anxieties were soon forgotten when my final visitor brought not petrol, but her glowering daughter, Susie Shuttle. Only now did I learn that Susie had a chance to be accepted at the Perth Nursing College, and her mother had insisted that she have Cricket Carter write the reference letter. Carter had been very keen to oblige. He had employed Susie on the spot, as a house girl for after school. I thought, how disastrous. But then again I saw the mother's point of view. A teacher was a weak and useless thing, but now, when the boss had not delivered, I was her only hope. Mr. Carter had the papers. They were sitting on his desk. How could I not offer my assistance? Chapter 20. An explosive incident like the one with Bennett Ash was the exception to the rule. I didn't usually lose my temper. I had been, if anything, too much the other way. For instance, when called a kraut in Bacchus Marsh, I remained my good-natured self, waiting a decent interval before sustaining an injury that would let me leave the football team without offence. That was my social habit or disability. So I went to visit Carter that evening, completely sure that we would conclude our negotiation amicably. I dozed while I waited for him to return from his day's work, and it was late when the lights of the Chev truck swept across my bedroom wall, and I heard the workers' soft voices as they drifted back towards their camp. I left him plenty of time to clean up and was surprised, on finally entering the big house, to pass the filthy cake of life buoy in the basin and discover, in the hiss and glare of the kerosene lamp, the boss alone at the table eating tuna from a can. His desolate face was smeared with grease, and his rum bottle was wet with soap and engine oil. Above all this, the punker swung, and the tepid air moved back and forth. In the no-man's land between dark and light, I found Tom Taylor's eyes. Carter was already speaking as I entered. "My old man," said Carter, "was a mechanic in Warwicknabeele. I thought I was getting away from all the grease monkeys when I went on the land." It was only then he spotted me. "Look," he said, and held his dripping hands up to the light. "Windmills. Bloody windmills, mate. Did you know Inigo Jones died?" Inigo Jones, of course, was the most famous long-term weather forecaster in Australia. "Jupiter," he said, "Saturn, Neptune and Uranus. Your anus," he said. "Jesus, Bill, take a joke." He wanted me to sit. I sat. He slid his tuna can towards me. "God, I missed them," he said. "I should have gone home for Christmas while I could." He drank. "Giddy up," he said, and I thought him impatient for me to eat the oily fish, but he was looking at the punker above his head. He twisted in his vast pearly chair to address Tom Taylor, who was standing behind his shoulder pulling on the rope. The punker waller raised his chin, and I saw his eyes much narrowed as his speed increased, and I thought how much he must loathe the station boss. Did he nod to me? It's possible. Carter, meanwhile, knocked his glass, but managed not to spill it. Of course I should have returned to my bed, but as it was obvious that he was in no state to write a reference, I imagined he might be pleased to have me perform that labour for him. Was I not aware that he had already formed an unsuitable alliance with my pupil? Yes. Did I understand he would not wish to let her go? Yes, yes, and yes. Then why on earth did I choose this moment to tell him that I had received a letter from the nursing college? "No, you didn't," he said. "They wrote to me," I said, although I was unschooled in lying, already beyond my limits. "If they'd written to you, bozo, I would have seen the bloody letter." I said he must have overlooked it. They had written to me only because they had not yet received a reference for Susie Shuttle. He was laughing now, and I was already tangled, knocking over my pieces on the board while he played his own loose anarchic game where everything could jump three squares at once. "There's not a letter comes in or out of Quambie Downs without me knowing. Of course they never wrote to you. They never heard of you, you little needle dick. I know what you're up to." So I had made a muddle of it, although this had the curious effect of making Carter happy. Indeed, he began to sing Late Night Susie, which was on the hit parade that year. "What are you going to tell your mother? What your daddy's going to say about your stocking ladders, now the milkman's been and gone?" It was not the tunelessness that made it awful, but the lascivious lips, the clear claim to carnal knowledge of a child in his employ. A flood of bile rushed through my cells. I beheld the creature on his filthy, pearly throne, and could have killed him. "You've come to make sure little Susie gets her reference. That's it." "I could write it if you're busy." "Good man!" he cried, rising from his seat and lurching towards his pig-pen desk, leaving me to confront his vacant throne and its back support, a kind of escutcheon where I made up the crude, fret-sword likeness of a crab. He knocked a weight from his desk. "Help your bloody self," he said. "Sit back down, relax." He thrust a letter into my hand, and I thought, I've won. But it was the request for a reference, nothing more. "You think I'm a mug?" He was too much behind me, hovering. "Never." "She's a great root, mate. You think I'm stupid?" The etymology of root is in rut, from Old French, meaning noise, roar, bellowing, which, even after it has entered the Australian language, still summons up visions of raw sexual congress. "A lovely, juicy little root," he said, and thus condemned himself. I asked him how long he'd had the request in his hand. Since the mail before last, he supposed. The wet season had held up the last two deliveries. There was someone lurking in the kitchen hut. The punker rode back and forth. Carter continued to stand behind me, shifting whenever I turned. "I could write it for you," I suggested, "and bring it in for signature in the morning." "Oh, you could bring it to me, could you? Have you lost your marbles too?" "Just trying to help." "It's called a psychotic breakdown. Just comes on you out of nowhere." "Why don't we sit back down?" "Why don't you back off? You lay a hand on her again, I'll fucking drop you." "Barry, you've got it wrong." "Mr. Carter to you." "Mr. Carter." "She doesn't want to be a fucking nurse. She's got a job at Quamby Downs. Why would she need another one?" Finally, there he was, where I could see him. I was sickened by the pasty glow of his skin, the gut above his belt, the corruption of his body. But still I was in perfect control of myself. Even when he crumpled the letter, I kept my cool. But then he cuffed my head, and I found myself in a place I only vaguely recognized. I grabbed his arm and found it more muscular than I had expected. He dragged me upright from my seat, but I tripped him up, and he fell heavy on his back, and we were rolling across the floor, and I could see the punkerwaller's bare feet and smell the rum and feel a disgusting intimacy as we rolled across my family history beneath his dinner table. And then he tangled in the chair, which rocked and tipped and fell, and I saw the inlaid pearl shell pop like confetti as the paper was forced into my mouth. "I'll take you to the bloody hospital," he said. I gagged. His upper lip pushed into his parrot beak, showing gums as pink as tonsils. "You know what we do with twats like you? You'll be in psychotic breakdown by the time I get you up to Broome. I'll have you declared insane. You don't know how easy it is. You'll have all the bungs you want in there." The crumpled paper cut my mouth and blocked my air. I bucked, but he had his knees on both my arms, and he plucked at my nostril. "You better say you're sorry." "I'm sorry." "Give up." I said that I gave up, and he let me go, but he hadn't expected this outcome, and he was wild-eyed and frightened. "You are the most pathetic little shit I ever saw," he said. He was standing very close, and it would have showed weakness to move away. "You could do 5 years for assault and battery." "Sign a blank sheet of paper. I'll write the letter on it." "Okay," he said, and slammed his arm around my neck. I had always been as slippery as a snake, and I took possession of his weight, his fat and muscle, and charged with him, his head first, towards the support post in the outer wall, colliding with Kev Little's pearly chair, which now revealed its hidden weakness and cracked and splintered and delivered unto me one heavy leg, a club with such a slender handle. With this I smote the bastard. His white arm cracked like a mud crab, the fibula the same, and with that my entire life broke through its shell and revealed the hidden secret of its true and final shape. The air was very still. The thunder crashed. Gently, the Punkawalla helped me to my feet, and now there was but one course available to me. Carter lay groaning while the rain fell like ball bearings on the metal roof. Then I was outside and in the downpour where Dr. Battery passed me a tobacco pouch. In shock, I watched Tom Taylor siphon the petrol directly from the Chev truck into the Peugeot, and then I saw young Susie and my brother Crowbar, and it was clear they were my friends and would not abandon me now. I fetched my notebook. There was room for 9 more flagons in the back. The Ark must be my refuge.
Chapter 21. I was 18 years old when I finally saw my father, Willem August Barkhuber. This first meeting took place on an airstrip in Broome in the midst of an enormous downpour, and was of a duration determined by an approaching cyclone and the need to refuel. After his 2 years of freedom, mostly spent in a cave in the Oscar Range, my father was a gaunt scarecrow in sodden shorts and t-shirt, who was now alone and unprotected in the middle of the storm while his police escort waited for him in the shelter of a fogged-up car. I felt not the least connection to this strange white man with springy wheaten hair cut high above his ears and a habit of looking down when he might be expected to look up. He had become, in a strange way, my duty. And if it had not been for my extraordinary guardian, I would never have known he was my father at all. Madison, however, had grown up imagining his own father was his cousin, and although he rarely interfered in my mother's very particular notions of child-rearing, on this question he exerted great authority. I must know Willie Barkhuber. This was why I had been sent to meet his books at Bacchus Marsh, and why I spent so many hours attempting to understand them. I sold them, too, of course, when Madison made me see them as a source of sustenance, like those infertile, trophic eggs which certain beetles leave solely to feed their offspring. To arrive at that destabilizing meeting in Broome, I had travelled on 3 tedious flights from Melbourne with my friend Ronnie Bobbs and his mother. As my own mum had no wish to ever see my father, it was Mrs. Bobbs who volunteered, and Mrs. Bobbs who paid for all the tickets, and Mrs. Bobbs alone who was not bored. On the contrary, she was hysterical. My father may have been, as so many have suggested, a meddlesome, well-meaning amateur anthropologist, but he was also a well-educated, deeply read man, an intellectual, whose soul had been seriously contorted as a result of his country's practice of ethnic cleansing. He was not the sort of character you would think to connect with this weeping woman across the aisle. Yet I will say, in her defence, she was always warm and affectionate with children. She was someone who made me jam sandwiches and took me and Ronnie to the Royal Melbourne Show. Obviously, something very grown-up had occurred between her and my father, but I still have no stable notion of what it might have been. As for Mr. Bobbs, I really have no clue. He was a famous car dealer and radio personality, and was in the tabloids for a while, but I have no recollection of him except, of course, those awful television ads in which he starred himself. It was not original to say that he seemed acrobatic, shiny, more like a wooden puppet than a man. Ronnie had stayed aboard our aircraft, and I was escorted into the deluge by his mother. I remember that the rain was warm, and my shoes were flooded. My father had no umbrella, and his hand was wet. He did not kiss me, although it had seemed he planned to do so, and then changed his mind. I have a strong sense he wished to say things to me, but that Mrs. Bob's bawling somehow got in the way. I was not angry that she denied me my natural meeting, but because she embarrassed me. Most probably I reported her behavior to my own mother, who presumably put an end to all those spontaneous swims and barbecues. If I did not see Bacchus Marsh again, it was certainly not my doing. This was a sad loss, but not a trauma. More seriously, I had to contend with the discovery that my so-called German father had carried the genes that made me Aboriginal. Thank God for Madison. He sacrificed much of his personal life to stand by me. Impossible as this would prove to be, I did not wish myself to be known or restricted by the color of my skin. For the longest time I was determined that this would have no effect on me at all, and I was readily annoyed with anyone who suggested otherwise. When my mother wished me to study medicine, that is what I did, thoughtfully gaining the scholarship to pay for it. And what human could study medicine in Australia without thinking of Aboriginal people, and therefore of cataracts, anemia, heart disease, diabetes, asthma, and pneumonia? I was so often exasperated by friends who concluded blithely that I chose my practice and my patients because of the color of my skin. Might it not have been my Hippocratic Oath, or my sense of common humanity? Were these not factors they might reasonably consider? My father was given 10 years in Fremantle, the maximum sentence for grievous bodily harm. I wrote to him regularly, as Madison had determined I should, and I suppose my letters were as dull and dutiful as a child in a boarding school. I read his letters with no more enthusiasm than I wrote my own, and it had to be pointed out to me that my father wished to tell me about that little school he had made on Quambie Downs. Why was it so hard for me to show an interest? Was I ashamed of him? Was I perhaps frightened of his loneliness and need? When he expressed the hope that I would visit his old schoolhouse, I doubt I even acknowledged the request. I passed my leaving certificate and matriculation with first-class honours. I was accepted for medicine at Melbourne University. My father continued as a prison teacher, and as so many of his students were inevitably Aboriginal, he continued his practice of collecting stories, making his non-maps and diagrams. He also, as I later learned, wrote regularly for Walkabout magazine, under the name of Eagle. Did any anthropologist read those columns at the time? These days they are much better known. Indeed, it's hard to think of a writer so frequently cited and so constantly belittled. We would say now that he reported the secret cults of opposition to white colonization. The expert view at that time was that such cults did not exist. To insist on them was to be a sensationalist or liar who could no more be believed than, say, Daisy Bates, whose tales of Aboriginal cannibalism are still attributed to her need to satisfy the lurid appetites of the popular press. My father was never one for lurid appetites. He was, rather, a man torn apart by two conflicting desires, one to record and the other to keep secret. That is, he would reveal or allege an Ark cult or a Ned Kelly cult or a Captain Cook saga, but then, the minute this vast wonder had been glimpsed, his only wish was to kick the whole damn thing out of sight. In my own experience, this was maddening. I was offended that he never thanked me for the time and money it cost me to finally visit Quambie Downs. By then, the magical schoolroom had become a whitewashed storage shed with no sign remaining of his labours, with the exception of the words, Captain Cook, whose component dyes had separated and risen to the surface, no longer quinky blue, but a ghostly orange bleed. Anyone aware of the continuing crisis in Aboriginal health will not be surprised to learn that Dr. Battery and the Punkawalla were dead, and Crowbar was in hospital, suffering the extreme consequences of acute diabetes. Of course, I understood my father's sadness. but I was his child, and yearned for gratitude as well. On his release from Fremantle, without me knowing it, he purchased a rifle and ammunition, and returned to the same cave in which he had finally been arrested. Here he somehow fed himself. By the time my friends in Derby led me out to the Oscar Range, where Willem Buckhuber and I had our adult meeting, he had made a replica of that other cave, his schoolroom. He had done this only for me, he insisted, and it had been the labor of bloody Hercules. Thanks, Dad. Using whitewash, ink, and twigs and brushes, he had fastidiously reproduced the saga of Captain Cook and all the maps or anti-maps and diagrams with which his students had instructed him. Here also, in the country of Jan de Mara, he learned many stories and dreaming tracks, and our first proper sit-down meeting took place inside a treasure house, a museum, the inside of a skull decorated with arcs and dots and lines of furry blue. I took this for what it was, an act of love, a vote of trust. Yet my father's trust had limits, as I discovered when I came upon a rusty Red-X Peugeot overgrown by wattles. The Red-X regalia was still legible, as was the number 62. Of course I was excited, but Willie's first inclination was to push this far away. It had nothing to do with his Red-X. Only days later did he admit to me that this was the car in which he had fled from Quamby Downs. Why would he not tell me that? Well, it was not interesting. The rusted wreck abutted a large rock outcrop, which was distinct not only because of its shape, but because in that vast Devonian limestone country it was rich in iron. It was a monolith about the length of a football field, with smooth, sheer sides like an axe blade, or, as I later thought, an upturned, rusty ship. I'm a doctor, not an anthropologist, but I have made enough inquiries to know that distinctive rocks often have a role to play in dreamtime stories, of metamorphosis, for instance. I mean, what seems to be a rock is sometimes so much more. With this in mind, I asked my father, was that big rock, in fact, the Punkawallah's Ark? After all, the journey of the Peugeot had ended here. Willie was not an overly jolly man, but at this simple question, he exploded in laughter, which continued far beyond any reasonable explanation. When he had gasped and spat and deary me'd, he teased me for talking like a white fella, with my mumbo-jumbo bulldust. He returned to his point continually for days to come, until I finally concluded that I had been correct. But what is a rock without a story, without its lore, its ritual? It is my belief that my father had collected these arcane formulae. This was what was stacked on the shelves in his cave, in his so-called mud books and his C-90 and C-120 cassettes. These last had stretched and deteriorated so badly they appeared to be beyond salvation, and are therefore no more interesting to the experts than the mud books, whose cores are generally thought to have been written during a period of breakdown. I have the distinct advantage of having read those mud books, which seem to me, far from being the product of a breakdown, to be driven by Willie Buckhuber's desire to preserve and pass down what he had found, while at the same time honoring his obligation to guard secrets. He had written so explicitly about an ark, I was slow to understand that he was not referring to the secret locus of the Punkawallah's cult, but rather his own hoard of notes, diary entries, tapes, accounts of a culture he has now spent a life protecting from malevolent destruction. If my father would not be clear, Professor, it is not because he had a breakdown, but because he must record the truth and keep the secret. What may seem to be the signs of madness might be understood by someone familiar with alchemical literature as an encryption, whose function is to insist that our mother country is a foreign land whose language we have not yet earned the right to speak.
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this production of A Long Way From Home by Peter Carey, narrated by Craig Baldwin, Saskia Marlveld and Colin McPhillamy. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.